Available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Welcome to Outlook. I'm Peter Walters, and this edition is being recorded on the 17th of April 2024. Coming up in this week's programme, we're at the Rollright Stones, way down in South Warwickshire, looking at the legendary stories around that. We're investigating a great escape that long predates the Second World War. We're talking about George Eliot's family, Dictionary Corner. We're also looking at the new West Midlands Police Museum and visiting Bradgate Park in search of the Nine-Day Queen. All of that a little bit later on, but first of all, this week's news with Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
Traffic changes, including a blanket 20 mile per hour zone in an area of Coventry, will go ahead despite objections. It was agreed last Wednesday. It comes amid a claim there is confusion over what is included in the final plans. The moves to bring in a so-called livable neighbourhood in Earlston were signed off by a senior councillor. The changes include closing roads to cars at certain points, raised tables to calm traffic, and new crossings. But the traffic orders to implement it were hit with more than 50 objections, according to a council report. Resident Nigel Lee suggested at yesterday's meeting that another consultation should be done on the final scheme. He added there is still confusion. There are still people uncertain of what is going on. Other residents also claim that some people were not aware of the plans and objected to other changes, although one person spoke in support of the overall scheme. But Head of Transport John Seddon said the latest proposals were not intended to show the entire scheme, but just the parts covered by traffic orders. He said any changes made at the meeting would be published. Councillor Patricia Heatherton said the council had tried to engage with as many people as possible. Speaking at the end of the meeting, she said, "Most of you have said you have no problem with making the area safer, making a 20 mile per hour zone. If it saves one life, then it will be worth it. Work on the traffic changes that will be brought is starting next month and expected to finish in August. One part of the plan, in a bid to cut through traffic, is particularly contentious. The change, known as point closure, on Arden Street, is part of a raft of measures to make the suburb so-called livable neighbourhood. But resident Denise Overton said it would have the opposite effect. Speaking alongside her husband Richard against the move, she told the meeting, "We are now going to be penalised for the journeys we make and for the ways we want to live our lives. We really feel like we have been sacrificed for this because of the so-called rat run on Arden Street." Mr. Overton claimed there would be no reduction of traffic as a result of the move and cars would simply take another route nearby. He raised concerns about the impact on air quality from the closure, which he said would affect four roads and two cul-de-sacs.
More than 100 people are running to be a Coventry councillor in this year's council elections. A list of candidates for the election on Thursday the 2nd of May has been published by the council. A third of seats at the authority will be up for grabs when polls open in less than 3 weeks' time. 12 of the 37 ruling Labour Group members and 6 of the 15 opposition Conservative councillors are hoping to be re-elected. High-profile councillors defending their posts include the leader of the council, Councillor George Duggins in Longford, and the leader of the opposition, Councillor Gary Ridley in Woodlands. 8 parties in total are fielding candidates in the race, although 2 of these have only nominated one person each. Of the 105 people vying for the residents' votes, four are independent. These candidates are running in two wards, Foles Hill and Upper Stoke. On polling day, Coventry residents will also be able to vote in the West Midlands mayoral and police commissioner elections. Polls will be open from 7am to 10pm on Thursday the 2nd of May, and the count will be held at the CBS Arena, with results announced the next morning. Anyone voting in person at a polling station will have to show an accepted form of photo ID following changes introduced last year.
Up to 400,000 pensioners are set to get warning letters from HMRC after a change this month means they will now have to pay a new bill, income tax. The warning comes after the state pension increased by 8.5% at the start of April. And while this is good news for many, it means that for some there will be income tax to pay. The rise in full basic state pension to £8,814 and new state pension to £11,502 means hundreds of thousands of people will be pushed into the income tax bracket. Anyone getting more than £12,750 has to pay income tax, which can include pensioners getting some other small income. The additional state pension comprises three different schemes. These include the state second pension, 2002-16, SERPs, 1978-2002, and the state pension top-up, 2015-2017. When combined with the basic state pension, these amounts could result in certain pensioners receiving an additional £200 per week, potentially exceeding the tax allowance. Tax expert Andy Wood from Tax Natives said, if your state pension or income is over £242 per week, you may face unexpected tax bills due to the frozen personal tax allowance. For example, those on the new state pension will see a weekly rise from £203 to £221. This means an extra £902 per year. While it's a boost, pensioners need to be aware of potential tax implications. He explained HMRC may use a simple assessment to notify pensioners of tax liability. This means you could receive a tax bill after the tax year ends. It's crucial to be aware of this possibility and to plan accordingly. Tax owed on state pensions is not automatically collected, as state pensions are paid in full before any tax deductions are made. Any tax due has to be paid before January the 31st of the next financial year. HMRC figures show that the number of those aged 65 and over who pay income tax increased by 10%, to 7.73 million in 22-23, to 8.5 million in 23-24, after the 10% increase in state pension in April last year, and partly due to the frozen tax-free limit.
A new 82-space car park will open in Coventry city centre. It will replace the new Union Street multi-storey car park, which is being demolished. The new facility will join with the next door 45-space Charles Moore car park, which is currently shut to the public. Drivers will use this access, and the car park will rationalise the layout to provide the spaces. The car park will have five disabled bays, and 5% of the spaces will be able to provide electric charging points. The move to transform the space obtained permission from the council last Thursday. Work to demolish the 1970s multi-storey car park started at the end of February and is expected to go on until mid-May. Coventry City Council has said the new surface car park on the site will be temporary. Speaking about the car park demolition, Councillor Patricia Heatherton said earlier this year that the site is past its best. She said it had turned into a bit of an eyesore.
Stolen dogs and bikes were found in a raid on a drugstone house in Coventry. A squad of officers swooped on an address in Stony Stanton Road. They found a large amount of suspected crack cocaine, heroin and cannabis, as well as dozens of stolen phones, electronics, stolen clothing and bicycles. They also seized an imitation gun, a knuckle duster, taser and a sword. Officers also uncovered a large amount of cash, as well as two dogs, which had been taken to the force's specialist kennels. Inquiries are now ongoing to examine the drugs and money and to reunite some of the stolen goods with their rightful owners, said a spokesperson for Coventry Police. During the raid last Friday, they found four people, one of whom was trying to hide in the loft space. All four were arrested, with two men aged 65 and 44, and a 36-year-old woman, subsequently bailed, having been arrested for possession with intent to supply Class A drugs, handling stolen goods and possession of an offensive weapon. Police say that the remaining suspect, a 42-year-old man, remains in custody for breaching the terms of a criminal behaviour order and possession with intent to supply Class A drugs. We are continuing to take action against drug dealing and organised crime in Coventry, with our teams regularly carrying out warrants and acting on information and intelligence from the community, the spokesperson added. This type of crime can have a devastating effect on the areas it takes place in, with risks to the community and wider city.
There's a dramatic image which captures the moment fierce orange flames tore through the roof of a former care home in Coventry. It was taken just before dozens of firefighters arrived at the old Applegarth care home last Saturday night. The ferocity of the fire ripped through the roof and into the first floor of the building as fire engines from across the city and from nearby Birmingham raced to the scene. They spent several hours fighting the flames which had destroyed the building. It was only 2 years ago when the old 22-bed care home was put on the market for £1.5 million after closing. Police believe that arsonists started the blaze which prompted the huge emergency services response and which led to Brownshill Green Road being closed for hours. As investigations are underway to find who was responsible, police have appealed for anyone with any information to come forward. We are investigating a suspected arson attack in Coventry, and officers were called to Brownhills Green Road to assist West Midlands Fire Service, who were dealing with the fire at a disused former care home, a police spokesman said.
Dinosaur-loving kids and adults will be able to feast their eyes on a brand new spectacle close to Coventry. In its new Land of Giants attraction at Maxstoke Park, which will play home to 50 life-size animatronic dinosaurs and Ice Age creatures with moving parts and sounds. It is touring the country and will be calling into the castle near Coleshill, which is usually only open to the public once a year. But the castle is opening ahead of May half term to welcome the attraction. The Land of Giants is a phenomenal day out for the entire family, said Naz Kabir, marketing and event director. We can't wait to open our doors and bring together dinosaurs and Ice Age creatures for the first time here in the UK. During the 90-minute experience, visitors can explore the park trails, gardens and parklands and uncover the epic beasts lurking among the hills, trees and bushes, as well as being able to embody their inner paleontologist and dig for fossils. Look out for a ferocious T-Rex, roaring woolly mammoths, an 8-metre triceratops and a 16-metre tall Diplodocus. The touring attraction will be at the 14th century fortified manor house with a moat from May the 18th to June the 2nd. This means you can pop along in the May half-term break from school. Tickets prices start from £14.50 per adult and £12.50 per child. To find out more or book tickets, check out the Land of the Giants website. There will also be food and drink trucks offering local and independent cuisine at the entrance and along the route.
Homegrown performers and acts have the chance to play at Godiva Festival this year. The flagship festival's Battle of the Bands, known as Godiva Calling, is back for 2024. The Godiva Calling winners will be given the chance to perform their own music on the main stage in front of thousands over the festival weekend in the War Memorial Park. To find the lucky acts, competition heats will be taking place at venues across the city in April and May. The heats are divided into six categories, with one winner chosen from each category: indie, urban, alternative, rock metal, singer-songwriter and under-18s. Sam McNulty, long-time organiser of Godiva Calling, said, "I encourage musicians from across Coventry and Warwickshire to take part in this unique competition. Bookings for the contest are being managed by the appropriate venues for each genre, while the under-18 categories will be managed by the Coventry Music Hub. Those who simply want to enjoy the festival, which runs from Friday, July the 5th to Sunday, July the 7th, can still get hold of tickets. Weekend tickets are priced at £41 and day tickets are from £12.50. Premium tickets are also available at £55 per day, and all tickets can be purchased via the Godiva Festival website."
The Coventry City FC is one of the clubs appearing on the world's longest multi-club football scarf. The Amazing Project is launching a brand new football camp for kids. The scarf features more than 70 football clubs across England, Wales and Scotland. It's all to mark the launch of Kellogg's Football Camps programme. In partnership with the English Football League, Manchester City, Celtic and Rangers, the football camps for girls and boys aged 5 to 15 will reach from Grimsby to Glasgow, Plymouth to Peterborough, supporting parents in keeping their kids active and entertained across the nation during the summer school holidays. To celebrate the announcement, Kellogg's is giving away 30,000 free places for the camps before they kick off this summer. New research shows that 59% of UK parents struggle to entertain their children throughout the school summer holidays. More than 80% want their child to experience less screen time during the break, and the same percentage believe that team sport is hugely important to learn valuable life skills. The 100-metre-long, impressive scarf is the result of more than 500 combined hours spent across design, knitting and sewing, with each club element hand-sewn by a team of specialists in Manchester. Chris Silcock, Managing Director of Kellanova, the company that owns Kellogg's, said, "Most families will be within 15 miles of a Kellogg's football camp, giving children up and down Britain an opportunity to get active this summer. Run by FA-qualified coaches, the camps aim to be fun and to give girls and boys the opportunity to get onto the pitch and follow in the footsteps of their footballing heroes."
Coventry pub The Old Crown in Alderman's Green has been described as a jewel of a place to visit, to eat and drink. TripAdvisor is full of hundreds of glowing reviews about the huge venue. It has no fewer than 833 excellent ratings on the traveller reviews, with one reviewer describing it as a jewel and that he was left stunned by the price of their meal, stunned in a good way. They posted, "I cannot believe the quality of food being provided here for the price. I've been twice in a week on the recommendation of a friend. Absolutely brilliant. Whoever is cooking here really knows their stuff. I've been to gastro pubs and not had meals like this. Fresh quality food cooked to absolute perfection. For such an unassuming place without all the bells and whistles, it's honestly top class. Don't tell everyone though, we don't want it spoiled. It'll be my new favourite for some time to come, I'm sure." Another praised the homemade pies, saying, "This is a great pub. Friendly staff, great food, and the atmosphere is inviting. I ordered the steak pie, and it was one of the best I've had in a long while. They are made in-house and had great pastry and plenty of meat in the filling." It was described as a must-visit place by another reviewer who said, "Amazing service and the friendliest staff I've ever encountered. Great portions with delicious food. More than happy to make alterations to the meal so that you leave happy. A must-visit if you're in the area. We will definitely return again." Another who gave the venue a 5-star rating said it was top shelf, explaining, "This place had everything you'd need for a quality evening. Everything was either exceptional or beyond, from the food to the service."
Mm. Coventry's Broadgate is set to be infused with the spirit of St George's Day as the city gears up for 2 days of vibrant celebrations later this month. Families and visitors can expect a lively atmosphere filled with mythical dragons, traditional entertainment and free activities for all ages. The festivities kick off this Saturday, April the 20th, with entertaining performances and interactive experiences. The damsels in distress, who will be accompanied by their mischievous dragons, will add a comedic twist to the celebrations. A parade featuring knights and their loyal peasants will weave through the city centre, complemented by the melodic tunes of the brass band of Central England, beginning at 11 a.m. until 3 p.m. On Tuesday, April the 23rd, St George's Day itself, from 12 to 2:30, the Coventry Morris Men will be performing with Smoked the Dragon. Organised by Coventry City Council, the events are suitable for all ages. Andy Williams, Director of Regeneration and Economy at Coventry City Council, said, "We're delighted to be holding a free, family-friendly event to celebrate St George's Day in the heart of the city. Those in the city centre will be able to enjoy the activities, watch performances from our entertainers, or simply enjoy the brass band music as it passes through Broadgate. Hundreds of visitors joined us for last year's celebrations, and I'm excited to see our very own Broadgate transformed again to mark St George's Day."
Outlook News.
Okay, thanks to our readers for this week's news, Elaine and Peter. I don't actually have the lighting up times in front of me as we speak, but I'm sure you'll know it when you see it, so we'll move on from that. We've got a couple of things to talk about here. First of all, we had a note from one of our listeners, Julia, who was requesting the memory stick from April the 3rd that she thought she'd missed. In fact, Julia, you didn't miss it. There wasn't one. We were on an Easter break, so don't worry about that. A couple of other things to talk about very briefly. There are a couple of events coming up in the next week or two. First of all, at the Belgrade Theatre in Coventry on 24th of April to the 27th, A Midsummer Night's Dream, with the Everyman Theatre Company presenting their new, all-new production. And at the Albany Theatre in Coventry on Friday the 26th of April, Irish Annies, Ash Murphy's musical comedy featuring live music and Ricky Tomlinson and Catherine Rice, who star in that one. Nigel's here, actually, with a reply to Jag's suggestions in Postbag just before Easter.
In Postbag, in the Outlook programme just before Easter, a new listener, Jag, made some good suggestions for additional features to add to the programme, to which I obviously need to react and respond, of course. His three suggestions were, firstly, get a tame solicitor to come to the studio from time to time to answer any previously received legal questions, whether about benefits, pensions, housing, 40 goods, or whatever. Secondly, he made recommendations for good... He suggested we make recommendations for good restaurants, bars, pubs, etc. And thirdly, to have interviews interviews with notable or interesting people about their life, their notable achievements, or whatever. So in response, Jack, I make the following comments. Legal advice. The Resource Centre, including the Talking Newspaper, hasn't got a remit to provide legal advice, though we are in a position to point people in the right direction with any problem they may have. Naturally, the first point of call would be citizens' advice, which is very much in the business of providing this type of help. In any case, legal problems, by their very nature, tend to be somewhat personal, and so often very little general interest. Nice idea, though. Citizen's advice, I think, is your port of call for that one, though. Turning to restaurants, etc., certainly make and welcome recommendations. And you will have noticed in the news just now, we have got a recommendation of a pub in Alderman's Green. Where we come across such recommendation in the Telegraph, or the Observer, or social media, or indeed, of course, some Outlook listeners, we will include them. But as a completely voluntary run organisation, Talking Newspaper, we don't have the resources or the money, I might add, unfortunately, to go trialling local venues. Finally, I would certainly welcome short interviews of, say, 5 to 10 minutes with local dignitaries, etc., from time to time to put into the programme. But this is something which needs considerable time and effort to research, find and arrange suitable interviewees, structure the interview, and actually do it, of course. Again, with a small team of volunteers, this is something we do not currently have the resources for. However, I did note in your postbag contribution, you actually slipped in or hinted, Jag, that you may like to consider doing these yourself. If you really would like to get involved, maybe we ought to discuss this and see how we can set it up, maybe. However, many thanks for your ideas. Please don't be put off by your somewhat negative reactions from me. Fresh thinking is always very welcome.
Thank you, Nigel. I think Peter wants to say something.
Yes. This is Peter. I run the walking group on Wednesday mornings, and in reply to Jag's request for refreshment suggestions, can I just please mention the drinks at the cafe in the War Memorial Park, not least the hot chocolates. The walking group always enjoy their drinks, and the cafe staff are absolutely superb, so if you're in the park, certainly the drinks there are worth having a go.
I'd echo that, they are very good. But we're moving on now, and as usual, Hugh is here with news from the Resource Centre.
Thank you very much. I was at the park on Sunday, and the cafe was rammed. So we went to the little ice cream kiosk down by the skate park bit, and it took a very, very, very long time to get ice creams. There were two feckless youths behind there who just had no idea what they were doing, and they had chocolate sauce and strawberry sauce all over themselves. It was quite funny. Everybody in the queue was sort of... they could have been annoyed, but they weren't. Anyway, hello, everybody. Random diversions there. So, just a few things to tell you about this week. Coming up in July, the 27th of July, so this is a little far ahead, there is an event called the Inflatable 5K. And what this is, it's basically a 5-kilometre race with inflatable obstacles. So it's going to be an awful lot of fun, and we've got Chris and Claire, and I think Joe and somebody else from the staff are taking part. But we have more tickets available and can get more. So the idea is we'll pay for your ticket to take part in this event, and then we ask everybody to sponsor you or whoever. So, I mean, we're not asking you necessarily, dear readers, to sign up for this, because it's quite an exercise. It'll be a whole lot of fun, I guarantee you that, people rolling around all over basically bouncy castles. If you know of anybody who's looking for an event to do for charity, maybe they're into their running, maybe they're into their sport, but you know, they think, you know, look, grandkids, they're great. You know, get them to do this and raise some sponsorship for, you know, a charity that's close to your heart. That would be a great idea. So if you could have a think about if there's anybody you know who might like to take part, you can get them to get in contact with Claire. So just call the centre on 024-7671-7522. Go through to Claire's extension, or they can email Claire, and it's Claire with an I, C-L-A-I-R-E, at crcb.org.uk to sign up. The event will take place at the University of Warwick on the 27th. It starts at 12 o'clock, so it's nice and local, and I think it'll be a really fantastic fantastic event for people to take part in. A lot of fun. Talking now, events that are happening a little bit sooner, we've got the Ulson Festival coming up on the 6th of May, so that's the early May bank holiday, the May Day bank holiday. We'll be running the charity shop going large in the car park event as well, and there will be the allotment group, we're having their plant sale as well, and also be selling our practically Robert and my's entire stock of rhubarb as well, but that sells well every year. To be honest, that raises quite a lot of money for the charity, so we donate our rhubarb to a very good cause, because we couldn't possibly eat all of it. We inherited a very large rhubarb patch, and I've got a rhubarb plant at home as well that does amply for us anyway. So definitely come along to that. You know, there's plenty going on in Ulson on that day. If the weather's fine, there are literally tens of thousands of people who come to Ulson. It's a lot of fun things to do. We're going to be other stalls available in the car park here as well. We're acting as a little bit of an overflow for people who didn't manage to secure stalls on the main drag. And we'll also be running refreshments here for the first time on that day. So this is an early call, but if anybody fancies making some cakes for us, we'd be very pleased to receive them, and we'll be able to sell those on the day, along with tea, coffee, hot chocolate, whatever. Well, hot chocolate, we're hoping we have to sell cool, cold drinks rather than warming hot drinks, but there we are. We keep our fingers crossed. It's been a terrible, terribly wet and cold, well, not cold, but just dank winter, isn't it? And we could do with a bit of bright sunshine, and maybe by May we'll get it. Who knows? For those of you who are going on the alpaca walk, that is happening on Saturday. So if most of you have this by Friday, if you're booked onto the alpaca walk with added meerkats, then make sure that you're ready on Saturday morning to go. I think most of you have got your transport arrangements all sorted, but if you've forgotten, then do give us a call at the centre, speak to Carl or Chris. So that's that one. Last week I talked about the bins, the green waste bins, and I referred to them as the green bins, and somebody came back to me and said, they're not green, they're brown. Well, the tops of them are. And it's like, so I'd just like to clarify that. The green bins have a brown lid, and so it's the green waste bins, and those are the ones that you're going to need to, from June, if you have garden waste to get rid of, you'll need to pay £40 per year per bin to get that bin emptied. You'll need to apply. You can do it by phone, but also online. If you have trouble with any of that, then we'll gladly help here. That £40 then will result in a very expensive sticker that you can stick to the back of your bin or the handle side of your bin, which will then mean that they'll collect it if they can see that there. It's a bit like the old fire insurance scam, wasn't it, back in the 19th century? So anyway, if you want to know more about that, read a book. go to Wikipedia. Bowls. Now, at the moment, Bowls is happening at the Haggard Centre in Willenhall, as it does over the winter and on very wet days. As of the... Oh, gosh, I didn't write the date down, but I think it is the 9th of May. Possibly it is... I'm going to have to check that now. As of the 9th of May, I think it's going to be at Spencer Park. So very soon it's going back to Spencer Park, and with the involvement, hopefully, of the Albany Bowls Club, as usual in the summer. If it's very wet on those days, then will arrange to go down to Willen Hall as we have been. There's still plenty of opportunities to buy the audio book, Who Turned Out the Lights. It's fantastic, and I do hope that people will get the chance to listen to it. You can go to our website, www.coventryblind.org.uk, and if you just put /books on there, that'll take you straight to a place where you can download it. That's Bandcamp. Or if you miss that bit, just go to our homepage, and there's a big button at the bottom of the homepage that you can press, and that'll take you to the same place. If you want it in sort of hard copy version, we have USB and CD versions available in reception for £5 a pop. The audiobook from Bandcamp, the downloadable version, is £4. And finally, the showdown table has been repaired. Yay! The man came yesterday and stuck it down. You'll remember perhaps that when it arrived to us, one end of the table had a big bow. It had come unstuck from its frame underneath, so it was bowed up on the playing surface. So the man came yesterday to stick it down and seal it up, and there are two very heavy tables on there at the moment, making sure it stays stuck down. So that is all. That's all good. So, Chris, hopefully next week or the week after, I'll be able to talk about when we're going to have a go day for Showdown, and then we'll start arranging the new club to get up and going. What's likely to happen is that we'll have a club that takes place during the day, and like any activity here, and then we're going to probably have, for those who are sort of more interested in taking part in matches with other Showdown clubs in the region, or indeed nationally, then we'll have a session, a weekly session, one evening as well. So there we are. Plenty going on as usual. I'll be able to. There's a big piece of news that I would like to tell you about, but if I do, I would get shot. Next week, I will be able to tell you about it in full detail. It's a piece of very excellent news about some funding that we've just got, so which is very good. So I should be able to talk about that in detail next week.
Right, I think we all look forward to that. Thank you very much, Hugh. Let's hope spring has finally sprung.
Oh God, yes.
For the awesome festival and your part in it, obviously amongst other things, and the bowlers. It's a big week for Coventry City with the FA Cup semi-final at the weekend, and Sarah will be on tenterhooks. Here she is with this week's sports news.
Well, hello there, listeners, and welcome to this week's sport. And unlike last week, there's actually been quite a lot of it this week. Now, I do hope to be bringing you sport next week, but I'm going with a bit of trepidation on the alpaca walk on Saturday, and I don't know what that runner, Chris Norman, has planned for us. So, if I'm not, you will understand. Right, I'll start off with football. However, a bit different this week, because to be truthful, I am so disillusioned with my club, the Sky Blues, that the less said about them, the better. In 1 week, since I spoke to you last week, they have lost both of their matches. And to me, the thought of the promotion via the playoffs is now out of the question. We are just losing ground. The one defeat, okay, was away to Southampton, who are definitely promotion contenders. So there was no disgrace there with the 2-1 defeat. But the 3-0 thrashing by Birmingham City last Saturday was just embarrassing. At that point, Birmingham were in the relegation zone and have had a dreadful record this year. Two particular quotes that I liked. Mark Robbins, our manager, said, "Yes, our play wasn't acceptable. The guys just didn't want to do any tackling." Well, of course they didn't, Mark. They got a rather big match next Saturday, but I'll tell you more about that in a minute. And the other quote that I did like was, one person in the CWR phone-in after the match suggested that at the big match next week, they install a cricket scoreboard for the number of goals that the opponents will score. Now, to put that in context, in their first innings against Durham, Warwickshire this week, despite the rain, scored 698 for three. Just think what it would have been if they'd batted for their whole team. Surely City can't lose 698 to nil. Although with City, you just never know. Anyway, I will mention that big match now. Next Sunday, and it is Sunday the 21st. That's why I'm going on the alpaca walk on the Saturday. It is the FA Cup semi-final at Wembley. And I think most City fans do think that City could still sneak this one. Because although we are playing the mighty Reds, as in Manchester United, City do have a habit on the big occasions and the one-offs of delivering the goods. Very few people thought we would beat Wolverhampton Wanderers away to get this far. Very few people thought we would beat Oxford to win the Chequered Trade Cup. And even fewer people thought we'd beat Tottenham Hotspurs to win the FA Cup back in 1987. So I'm hopeful that I will be celebrating rather loudly next week on the programme. But who knows? Now, moving down to our lower league, or officially called non-league clubs, our two highest ranked teams being in the Southern League Central Premier, or words to that effect, are both still in the playoff zone for promotion. Leamington beat Stanton 3-0, while Stratford were away to Micklover and drew 1-1. So what that's actually meant is they're both still in the promotion zone, but they've or the playoff zone, but they've swapped places. Now, just a huge shout out to our rugby lads. On Sunday of this week, they travelled to Nottingham and thrashed them as well. Not quite as well as they thrashed Cambridge last week, but 26 points to 52 is pretty damn good going. And I will tell you more about the Women's Six Nations Cup next week. Other than, if you're not watching it, England are doing rather well, unlike in the men's. But sadly, it looks as if the Welsh women, just like the men, will be going for the wooden spoon. So staying now with national sport. This weekend, or the last weekend rather, saw the first round proper of the Billie Jean King Cup. Now, the Billie Jean King Cup, gosh, got to get my mouth around that one, used to be called the Federation Cup, but in 2016 it was changed to the BJK Cup. And it is the women's equivalent of the men's Davis Cup. Now, this first round was between Great Britain and France and was to win the right to play in the big finals, which sees 12 teams initially start on a round robin. And Great Britain were taking on France, who you may recall they lost to at this time last year. Now, I went into this with quite a heavy heart because it was billed as basically the return of the Raducanu to competing for Britain. But was I to be proved wrong? My gosh, Emma Raducanu really pulled it out of the bag and won both of her matches. Casey Bolter lost her first match but won her second, meaning that Great Britain won, they beat France 3-1, and are now through to the final 12 in the competition, which will take place apparently in November. Of course, that's after the Olympics. Now, you may have heard in national sport that there was a rather big golf tournament going on in the States. In fact, it was one of the four majors, as they're called, the US Masters. And it was won quite well by Scottie Scheffler, with a young Swede, Ludvig Asper, second, which was a new name on the scene. Good to hear. Now, what makes me laugh is that they all talk about to win the green jacket, which is a sort of ceremonial prize. I don't think they get a trophy, but they get a green jacket, which they get to keep. Well, would you really play 4 rounds of golf for a green jacket? Of course they don't, but I'm sure the £2 million prize money helps sweeten the pill. Golf is also in the Olympics, which are only 100 days away now, and Sarah is getting very excited. But while we're talking about the Olympics, I'd be interested to hear your opinion of Sebastian Cohen Athletics' idea, well, it's actually happening, of awarding the medal winner, I believe it's only the gold medal winner, prize money. Now, this will not be something given to British athletes should they win. This will be an Olympic-backed prize money. That is such a major change. I mean, I remember the Olympics when it used to be amateur. Well, obviously, I can see that now with the amount of money in sport, it's being totally amateur would apply. But I'm also a bit cynical anyway, because even more so than the prize money, £40,000 for these top class athletes is sweetie money, pocket money, given the huge sponsorship deals that they have with their clothing manufacturers or equipment manufacturers. And I'm talking about multi-million pounds. And going back to the golf and talking about money here, the world number one at the time, John Rahm, was given a £400 million golden hello when he joined the LIV Tour. LIV, you may recall, is the Saudi-backed breakaway from the PGA. Money in sport has just gone crazy. But now, anyway, let's get back to the sport. Now, linked to the Olympics, as in that it's a multi-sport event, the Commonwealth Games 2026 still has no definite venue, and time is getting very close. You may recall that I told you that Victoria in Australia, who'd had the flag and taken over ceremoniously at Birmingham, withdrew due to financial costs. And there haven't been really any other interests. A few countries have dipped the toe in the water, but have subsequently said no. However, Glasgow has agreed to be a stand-in if no other country can be found, and I think the cut-off date is quite soon. Glasgow has agreed to do a sort of cost-limited Commonwealth Games, and by that they're looking particularly at reducing the cost of accommodation. I mean, yes, I'm sure it's very nice for all these athletes to be housed in top-class hotels, but they don't really need it. I mean, nowadays, even student halls of residence are luxurious. But most importantly, to limit the number of sports to between 10 and 13. It's currently 18. And these sports will be at the behest of the organiser. In other words, probably I would imagine the ones that they've already got facilities for. Because gone are the days when you hosted a big event and built new facilities. But I mean, obvious in this for Glasgow would be hockey. They have a top class hockey arena. Cycling, they have a very good, I believe it's called the Emirates. That's a bit confusing for Arsenal fans. Velodrome, and also could indoor athletics be introduced, because they've recently staged the World Indoor Athletics Championships. I do know that outdoor athletics will be more of a problem, because last time they were staged in Glasgow, which was only 2014, they used Hampden Park, which has since been redeveloped, and I assume the athletics track has gone. Anyway, wouldn't that be great? Because they'd be in our time zone. And of course, the Olympics is almost in our time zone, being in Paris. Yeah. And finally, have you heard about Yaya Pandor? Well, this was on the news yesterday, but for those of you who haven't, I'm going to tell you. Yaya is a 28-year-old local government officer and councillor who happens to be blind and just happened to have run a full marathon in Manchester without a guide, presumably relying on crowd noises and the grunting and breathing of other runners, and also in a mass marathon, the sort of breathing and being crushed in. But that wouldn't stop you or enable you to see steps, and there are curbs on marathon courses, all those pesky bollards that used to be literally my downfall sometimes. A lot to think about there. But as Yaya says, when he lost his sight and he went blind in 2020, having gone through the gradual losing process, he decided life was going to be about setting challenges. Well, running a marathon 26.2 miles when you're blind and without a guide is certainly what I call one heck of a challenge. Well done, Yaya. And that was your sport for this week. So do have a fantastic week. And don't forget the City ITV 3:30, or as I always say, BBC CWR. Bye.
Fingers crossed for Sunday. Thanks to Sarah for this week's sport. Now here's Dave with this week's postbag.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello there. A big welcome to your postbag. Tell us what you've been doing lately. Julia has been out for a healthy walk with the Resource Centre's walking group. Her report is entitled, A Walk on the Wild Side. My friend Marianne went for a walk with me the other day. We went to Memorial Park. It was one of the Wednesday walks. Bit like the Monday Club, only on a Wednesday. As we left the Resource Centre, we passed some houses. Then we came to some benches with people's names on them because they were dead. They had flowers round the benches, and then we came to a big car park where people catch the park and ride. There were lots of blind people with us, and some had guide dogs. But I know which bit you've all been waiting for. We eventually got to the cafe and hired a hot chocolate with mint in it. It was lovely. When we got back to the Resource Centre, we had walked for 40 minutes and completed 2.8 miles. That's more than my friend John has walked since Christmas 2022. I do at least three types of exercise now. I go walking, tandem rides, and to the gym. My friend John only exercises when he's eating or drinking, which is most of the time. No wonder he's so fat. Julia. Well, if you like eating chocolate, Edwina has some good news for you, but eat it in moderation, otherwise you too will get fat.
Hi everybody, it's Edwina. Are you a chocolate eater? This is just a little bit of information about dark chocolate. Dark chocolate is actually good for you. It contains magnesium, iron and zinc, which are all very good for your body. It is something you should eat in moderation. I do know that if you want to treat someone with chocolate, it actually has diabetes. The dark chocolate is best, but eaten in moderation. Take care then, everybody. Bye.
Thank you, Edwina. Just a footnote. Eating dark chocolate could promote a healthy heart, but eat it in moderation. And I must add that if you are diabetic, consult with your doctor or dietitian before eating it. Now, Edwina has been for a long time passing on tips in Postbag about coping with a visual impairment. We welcome back Jag Singh, who wants to start a WhatsApp group for visually impaired people to share their experiences and concerns. Here's Jag to talk to you.
Hi guys, my name is Jag Singh, and I've got an idea which I'd like to put out to our local community, just to support each other really. More people speak to visual impairment, or people in general, there seems to be a lot of isolation or a lot of frustration, just maybe not knowing how to deal with a certain situation or wanting to ask somebody a question and see if there's answers available. I joined a talk and support group with the RNIB, and it was really quite helpful, but the other thing is that a lot of the people in that group can be spread all over the country, so they don't really have a great knowledge of your local area or local facilities. And I was wondering if anybody would be interested in a sort of support WhatsApp group. WhatsApp groups seem to be the new fashion or the new thing, and I think they have a great deal of support available. If we pull our knowledges together, we can come up with great answers and solutions, and just supporting each other. Otherwise, life can be quite isolating. I don't know if anybody feels about that. I'm happy to create the group if that's okay with everybody, and just where we can support each other, encourage each other. Sometimes getting out and about isn't always that easy. It can be a little bit expensive as well. But if it's just a simple problem that maybe somebody's got the answer to, I think it'd be a tremendous way, and especially if we're all locally based, we will know what's available in our area, or maybe a good person. Me, for example, I'm a local landlord. I've got some great tradespeople that I use, real good carpenter that I can happily recommend people, a gardener, etc., etc. And I think if we all pull our collective knowledge and support each other, then life doesn't feel so frustrating and so isolating. If anybody is interested in this support WhatsApp group, feel free. I don't know whether this is okay, but I'm going to leave my contact number, 077 9258 1465, and hopefully it can end the isolation that sometimes we feel, and sometimes the frustration as well when we can't get things done. But collectively we can pull our knowledge, our contacts and our experiences together and keep supporting each other. Hope to hear from people soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Jag. If you're interested in joining Jag's WhatsApp group, please give him a call. But for 40 years of presenting Postbag and a bit before, I've been trying to persuade listeners to do exactly what you've been talking about, sharing experiences, concerns and tips concerning visual impairment in Postbag. So good luck with the WhatsApp group, but feel free to get people talking in Postbag, Jag. Now, Amy Clennell has her own YouTube channel for her poems, which was launched at a Coventry book extravaganza at the Belgrade Theatre, hosted by the Belgrade Theatre's pantomime dame Ian Lachlan, whom I introduced Amy to. This week, she talks about being on the panel at the book day, and she was wearing a lovely red dress.
At the actual event on Saturday, I should say that I was a bit nervous about being on the panel with other poet laureates. There was the young poet laureate, her name was Amani Kanda, and there was the overall poet laureate, John Bernard, and I didn't know what I was going to be able to do, but in the end, it was just Ian asking us all the questions. I was up first, so that was a bit daunting, but once I knew it was just Ian asking me the questions and me answering them, I was okay.
Well done, Amy. And if you want to listen to Amy's lovely poems and her telling you how she came to write them, please type Amy Clennell, spelt C-L-E-N-N-E-L-L, on YouTube. The poems were updated on Fridays. More from Amy next week. And now, here's some sad news from Bob Syme.
Hello, this is Bob Syme. I'd just like to say about bad news, I'm afraid, for me. I lost my wonderful, wonderful guide dog on the 13th of March. He had cancer on his leg, a lump come, and the vet come and took an x-ray, and it had gone into his bone, so nothing could be done. That was on the 18th of January, so we kept him going. Fine, it was fine, but the swelling had got as big as bigger than a tennis ball. And he couldn't cope with it any longer, so I had to call the vet to put him to sleep. I'm afraid it's my third guide dog, and I'm absolutely heartbroken over it. Being on my own, I contacted guide dogs, and they says they need to see me, two different visits from guide dogs, and said the waiting time could be anywhere from 6 months to 2.5 years, which isn't very good news, seeing as I'll be restricted to my house. And did I want long time training? I says no. I've always had a guide dog for the last 26 years. And it was such a wonderful, wonderful, huge dog. It was 8 stone German Shepherd called Topper. It's heartbreaking when you're on your own and company. I knew the channel, Carol Blossom, had recently had a dog, Keith, and I was looking for your number, Carol. I know I've got it somewhere, but it's on a memory stick, so if you could ever get time to give me a little ring, I want to ask a couple of things about guide dogs. I'm on 763-3-7592, that's the landline number, and we'll see where we go. I'm stuck at the moment, only goes out with my cousin when she'll take me shopping or out for a meal or with a friend, Carol. I ride her daughter's horse. I'm still horse riding as well. I'm lost without a dog. I keep walking around his water bowl and his food bowl and his bed. They're not there now. I'll put them away in the garage and wait till I ever hear about getting another dog. I've just got to keep busy in the garden because I've got a very large garden, as I've told people before. So it's just a bit of bad news, I'm afraid, for me. All the best for everyone else. Take care. Bob Syme.
Thank you, Bob. We are thinking about you. And if you have a message for Bob, please send him one in postbag or contact him direct. Thanks for your messages this week, and please let's hear from you next time. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
And that's this week's Postbag with Dave. We're very keen to hear from you, so please keep those thoughts coming. The Royal White Stones on the border of Warwickshire and Oxfordshire are, legend says, all that remains of a king and his army, and they must not be removed. This article from Countryfile magazine is read by Elaine.
Britain's ancient stone circles are magical places, and midsummer is a magical time. Many people still visit standing stones at this time of year, and leave offerings of freshly picked flowers. It's also said that at midnight on Midsummer's Eve, some of the stones dislocate themselves from the ground and roll down to the river for a drink. A few years ago, late one afternoon in June, Martin Maudsley decided to visit the distinctly atmospheric Rollwright stones on the Oxfordshire-Warwickshire border. A ring of grey stones of varying shapes and sizes nestled into the grass, hidden behind a tall, summer-scented hedgerow, some being 1.8 metre or 6 feet tall. A well-known local legend recounts the stones' mythical origins. Long ago, a foreign king with an invading army arrived in this part of England, where he was immediately confronted by an old witch, who prophesied, "Seven long strides shalt thou take, and if Long Compton thou canst see, King of England thou shalt be." The king defiantly marched uphill, but on his seventh stride the ground rose up before him, and he wasn't able to see over the ridge to the village of Long Compton beyond. Unable to complete the task, the witch called out, "Rise up, stick, and stand still, stone, for King of England thou shalt be none." Thereupon she turned the king and his nearby knights into a tall standing stones, and herself into an elder tree, while below his whole army was also petrified, fixed in a circle, where they stood waiting for their monarch to return. According to local superstition, it's now impossible to tell exactly how large that army was, because anyone who walks around the stones and tries to count them arrives at a different number each time. It certainly appeared to be true to Martin. His first circumnavigation tallied 74, the second 77. He was part way round for the third time when he noticed someone else, an elderly man leaning on a stick who was watching him with a wry smile as he tottered and tottered his way round the stone circle. "Ah, I can never make them old stones add up either," the old boy said. "Even accounting for the one that was once removed and brought back again." Martin sensed a country tale ripe for the picking. There was once a local farmer, a money-minded man who, while renovating his barn, had a grand idea to incorporate one of the Rollwright stones into the building. His neighbours were united in their disapproval, and the task was hard enough to accomplish, but the farmer himself was determined. The deeply set stone needed plenty of digging, and once loosened required the strength of his two cart horses to pull it out and drag it home. No sooner was the stone fixed into its new position, however, than the farmer's fortunes began to dramatically decline. Not long later, both of his horses collapsed and died, and the cart they once pulled was stolen in the night. The yield of his milk cows gradually diminished, and his corn that year refused to ripen. By the end of the summer, the wretched farmer was at his wits' end, and in desperation decided to return the ancient stone to the circle. With great difficulty, he prized it out of the barn wall, but, without any horses left to haul it, had to resort to painstakingly rolling the stone himself across the fields on wooden logs, perhaps echoing the way they'd been transported in ancient times. Eventually, the stone was levered upright and dropped back into its hole, and at the end of the day, the farmer returned home with heavy arms and legs, but a lighter heart. Sure enough, the reparation of the stone to its rightful place restored his fortunes. The milk began to flow once more, and the crops started to flourish again. Soon he had acquired enough wealth to be able to buy himself more horses and a new cart. But as long as he lived, he never meddled with old stones ever again.
Back in the 14th century, nobleman Richard Mortimer, imprisoned by King Edward II, made a fabled getaway from the Tower of London. The story of his great escape has come down through the centuries, and this is part two of a new version of the tale, written by Annie O'Brien and read by Bill.
How did Mortimer break out? Surely the tower was impregnable, from within and without. In fact, the tower was not always the formidable fortress it might seem today. Some of the inner buildings had been allowed to fall into a dilapidated state, with rain even coming through the roof of the royal apartments. In particular, the kitchen roof was in disrepair, its timbers needing to be replaced and all retiled. Until that was done, there were significant holes. This was the perfect route for Mortimer's escape. He was able to break out through the crumbling walls of his cell, from where he could easily reach the kitchens. There were still major difficulties to overcome. Mortimer had been supplied with rope ladders. Climbing out through a hole onto the kitchen roof, he scaled the inner curtain wall of the tower into Walter Lane. From there, considerable athleticism. Could climb the outer wall and drop down to the banks of the Thames. Drugged wine and beer obviously worked well. While the prisoners of 1944 had to cope with the shortfall in their tunnel, Mortimer's escape went perfectly to plan. Once on the banks of the Thames, all had been meticulously organised to get him out of England. Friends were waiting with a boat to row him across to the opposite side. At a nearby mill, horses were ready. He was helped on his way south towards the coast, to Porchester, from where he took the waiting ship to the Isle of Wight, and then on to refuge in France. On learning of his escape, the king ordered a hunt for his enemy through the entire country, but to no avail. Was one of his collaborators Queen Isabella herself. She warned Mortimer of her husband's plan to have him executed. We know she spent time in the royal apartments in the tower, and eventually became his lover during a trip to France. The result of his escape? Mortimer's wife Joan, suspected of being capable of stirring up a rebellion in her husband's name, was placed under restraint. Skipton Castle in Yorkshire. His children too were imprisoned, girls sent with their mother to convents, boys locked up in Windsor Castle. Meanwhile in France, Mortimer became the focus of attention for all who opposed the land-grabbing favourite, Hugh de Spencer. Eventually, 3 years after his escape, he was able to raise sufficient money and troops to aid his return to England, intent on recovering all the lands and titles that had been stripped from him. With him came Queen Isabella, who had been living at the court of her father, the King of France. There is little doubt that by this time their return, they were lovers. The rest is quite another story. The success of this escape from the Tower of London would result in the forced abdication of the king, ruling power in England passing into the hands of Roger Mortimer and Queen Isabella. On his return to England, Mortimer acknowledged the importance of the intervention of St. Peter. God and his saints had quite definitely been on his side. He ordered the building of a chapel, St. Peter ad Vincula, within his castle at Ludlow, to give thanks for his escape. Although ruined, the chapel still exists. Like the prisoners of the 1944 Great Escape, Roger Mortimer has never appeared in film, nor are there any paintings of him. The story of his thrilling escape lives on. 700 years before the men of Stalag Luft danced their own, Mortimer's escape from the tower is one of the most dramatic parts of the new novel A Court of Betrayal. The connecting link between his treachery and his seizing power as king in all but name. For this, the author is grateful to the chroniclers of the day, who wrote just as well as the modern historians, who find the Mortimer story of courage, treason, and betrayal a captivating subject. If Mortimer had not escaped, he would certainly have died in the tower, and his line would have faded into obscurity. What an impact this would have had on our English history, since, through the carefully arranged marriages of the Mortimer children and their descendants, future Yorkist kings of England, Edward IV and Richard III, were descended directly from Roger and Joan.
The writer George Eliot was born on the Arbury estate on the edge of Nuneaton, but Coventry features prominently in her life and the lives of her family. This article, featuring a relative of the writer who lived in Alsley, is taken from the March issue of the Earls and Echo and read by Keith.
Did you know that one of George Eliot's relatives lived for many years in Alsley Old Road? Her name was Mary Woodis, and she was one of the novelist's cousins. She had a letter published in the Coventry Evening Telegraph on the 12th of October 1927, in which she said it was not true that there were none of George Eliot's cousins left alive, despite people frequently claiming that this was the case. She herself was a cousin of George Eliot, and there were other relatives to be found in Waterhouses and in Ellerstone in Staffordshire. Robert Evans, the author's father, was born in Ellerstone. It is clear from her letter that Mary Woodis was proud of her famous relative. You can tell this from the way she told how, for many years, her mother kept the bonnet which had belonged to her, Mary's aunt, Elizabeth Evans, on whom George Eliot based the character of Dinah Morris in Adam Bede. I remember attending a talk by John Burton of the George Eliot Fellowship about the diary of Alice Evans, another relative of George Eliot, and it was obvious that she too honoured the achievements of Eliot. When Mary wrote to the Telegraph in 1927, she gave her address as Oakden, Alsley Old Road. In 1936, a report in the Evening Dispatch told how Mrs. Woodis had celebrated her 85th birthday. She was still living in Alsley Old Road. In subsequent reports, her house was simply given as number such and such Alsley Old Road, but I suspect it is the same house. In an article in the Coventry Evening Telegraph on 28th of March 1941, it tells how she moved to Coventry in around 1901, having previously lived at Rectory Farm, Bedworth, for a short while. The house where Mrs. Woodis was living when she celebrated her 85th birthday still exists. It is a red brick terraced house, a spacious property with about a bow window. At first I did wonder whether Mrs. Woodis would have missed the countryside. the Midlands countryside, which Georgie Eliot described so marvellously in her novels. But then I looked at David McGrory's illustrated history of Coventry suburbs and realised that when Mrs. Woodis was living there, vestiges of countryside still remained nearby. And indeed, Farmer Green could often be seen driving his cows through the streets of Chapelfields. As well as talking about her famous relative, Mrs. Woodis also mentioned how, on her first visit to Coventry, she had travelled on an electric tram, and it had made her and those she was travelling with ill, so much so that they decided to return home by train. Mary died in 1941 at the age of 89. I do think that it is interesting to discover that Mrs. Woodis admired George Eliot. We cannot take this as a given. After all, we know that George Eliot's brother Isaac was estranged from his sister because of a relationship with George Henry Lewis. And I can remember a colleague of mine telling me that there were still people in Nuneaton who disapproved of the novelist. Mary may have honoured her relative's memory, but there is no evidence that she shared her creativity. However, Sheena Porter, great-great-niece of George Eliot, became a children's novelist, and in 1965 won the Carnegie Medal for her book Naughtybank.
Next, we're moving on to Dictionary Corner by Susie Dent, taken from the Radio Times and read by Margaret.
Dictionary Corner, Pineapple. Have you ever wondered what the pine is doing in pineapple, or the grape in grapefruit? Pineapple was originally the name given to the conical fruit of the pine tree, what we would now call a pine cone. When the large tropical fruit was introduced to Britain in the early 17th century, both its shape and rough segmented skin were thought to resemble a pine cone, and so the name pineapple was transferred to the fruit instead. As for the grapefruit, this name has perplexed us for some time. Victorian traveller Lady Annie Brassey wrote with bemusement of the grapefruit in 1884. It does not bear the slightest resemblance to a grape. The key is way it grows in clusters on the tree, which, when the fruits are young and green, look like bunches of grapes. Cataract. Many words in English have multiple meanings that are so different from each other, it's hard to imagine any connection. One of these is cataract, which can mean both a spectacular waterfall and a medical condition of the eye. But the two meanings are in fact related. In Latin, cataracta, from the Greek cataractes, or downrushing, meant both a waterfall and a portcullis, a grating pulled down to close a gateway. It was this meaning that inspired the use of cataract for the clouding of the lens of the eye, as if a gate has been lowered, obstructing vision. It's not the only eye condition with a backstory. Glaucoma is derived from the Greek for an owl, glauks, because the bird was thought to have eyes similar in colour to those of a glaucoma sufferer. Lollygagging. The pleasing sound of lollygagging reflects its meaning of wandering aimlessly or dawdling. But in the 19th century, when the word began to appear, the main application of the word, which was sometimes spelt lallygagging, was more to do with romance than time-wasting. To lollygag was to engage in flirting or cuddling. This meaning broadened to fooling around, but the original meaning of necking led one Navy captain to warn in 1946, "Lovemaking and lollygagging are strictly forbidden. The holding of hands, osculation, and constant embracing of waves, women accepted for volunteer emergency service, is a violation of naval discipline. Osculation is the technical word for kissing, which was clearly viewed as a precursor to lollygagging. Paragon. The ancient Greeks were no strangers to battle. Many expressions in English derive from their wars, such as Pyrrhic victory, which takes its name from a Greek king who defeated the Romans in 279 BC, but incurred heavy losses. The phrase, a paragon of virtue, is also connected to ancient conflicts. When preparing for war, Greek soldiers would hone their spears, swords, and axes. The Greek for sharpen was akonon, which was combined with the prefix para to mean sharpen against. Centuries later, the Italians adopted the word in the form of paragone to mean a touchstone used for testing the purity of gold. It's from here that English took the idea of a model of excellence, in particular, someone against whose morals the rest of us should be judged. Recipe. It may be an ordinary word, but recipe has a history few of us would guess at. Its original meaning in the 16th century was as an instruction for the correct use or dosage of a medicine on a doctor's prescription. The word is a straight borrowing from Latin, in which recipe, recipe, means receive. Over time it was transferred to the prescription or remedy itself, such as a cordial, originally a health-giving tonic intended to stimulate the heart. By the 17th century, recipe was broadened to mean a description of the correct procedure for making something, especially a dish in a cookery, which was also sometimes known as receipt. Today, the medical sense of recipe survives in the R or the RX, used by doctors as an abbreviation for a prescription.
There's always been a lot more to policing in the West Midlands than Peaky Blinders, and the West Midlands Police Museum in Birmingham offers both a fascinating insight and a unique day out in the heart of the city. Written by Jessica Clixby and read by Nigel.
Birmingham's West Midlands Police Station is an unassuming red brick building situated on the city's Steelhouse Lane and only 5 minutes' walk from Snow Hill Station. The popular visitor attraction will soon celebrate its second birthday after opening its doors in April 22. The building was a fully functional lock-up from 1891 until 2016, a place to hold people after they had been arrested. In most cases, prisoners would spend less than 24 hours in the building before being sent to trial in the courts next door. Intriguingly, this journey was made through a tunnel between the two buildings, which can still be seen in the museum's basement. Visitors spend a moment behind bars in the entrance lock-up and check in at the erstwhile charge desk, now a reception desk, before making their way to the main prison block. Unlike the blue police box on display from Coventry, which is a hit with visiting Doctor Who fans, the museum really does seem bigger on the inside. Metal grill balconies give access to the cells on each floor. From any point in the main building, it's possible to see all the way down to the basement and up to the glass roof. This is actually a 130-year-old security feature, allowing police officers to see and hear trouble arising, even 2 floors away. Unsurprisingly, the open feeling doesn't extend to the cells. Many lack windows, and in their original form were lit only by a candle in a recess high up on the wall. On busy nights, multiple prisoners could occupy one cell, an unsettling thought for those free to wander in and out of cells as they please. When safer prison conditions were implemented in the early 21st century, 4 cells were kept in their existing condition, honouring the building's Grade 2 listed status and providing a glimpse of its former life. Each cell now hosts an exhibit covering anything from early police bicycles to corporal punishments and stories of people who were detained there. The museum is run by a tight-knit team of staff and a large bank of volunteers, which includes serving and retired police officers. It's supported by both the Heritage Fund and West Midlands Police and promises a unique perspective of life on both sides of the bars. Real care has been taken to maintain this balance, and the staff do everything they can to ensure that visitors have a grand day out. Engagement Officer Archie creates bespoke programmes for visiting schools, and the museum boasts a huge amount of educational material, designated space for sessions, and an enthusiastic team to deliver them. School visits can even include sleepovers, where pupils bunk down in cells. There is a forensic trail in the basement where visitors solve a crime by collecting clues, fingerprints, and plaster casts of footprints. On occasion, crime scenes feature Camilla, a full-size mannequin donated and named by the hospital next door. As well as catering for younger visitors, the museum also offers popular murder mystery nights, giving would-be detectives the chance to catch a murderer by interviewing suspects dotted around the cells. There's also a host of after-hours talks, events and activities to suit visitors with darker tastes. Fans of true crime can hear stories of murder and mayhem and see some of the more ghoulish items in the museum's collection at the bespoke event called the Macabre Museum on Sunday the 14th of April. Not for the faint-hearted and limited to visitors over 18 years old, the event provides an opportunity to see the most notorious items in the venue's archives. There are also regular after-dark ghost-hunting tours of the building, which feature spooky stories of strange sightings and mysteries from around the West Midlands and the lock-up itself. Talks by visiting West Midland police officers and experts in related history complete the programme. Previous talks have included deep dives into the history of the real Peaky Blinders, a moniker that was never used by the police. The talk was hosted by well-known local historian Professor Carl Chin, who has a family connection to one of the gang members. In addition to events and activities, the museum houses an impressive archive of records and artifacts, including some of the country's first prisoner mugshots dating back to the mid-19th century. Photography was a luxury commodity at that time, and the collection's photos are often the only remaining images of these people. Members of the public investigating their family history occasionally approach the museum to check these records, and the staff are happy to oblige, although searching through them is no mean feat. Some of the archives' items, ledgers, photographs and historic uniforms are on permanent display. To see more of the collection, visitors can book a behind-the-scenes tour. These are generally scheduled during Birmingham Heritage Week in September. Each month at the museum is themed to celebrate a different facet of the police force and its history. In March, the focus was on diversity within the police, while April will mark the 50th anniversary of the West Midlands Police forming. The museum will be celebrating the occasion throughout the month, and the build-up to the anniversary is already in full swing. Check out the website and social media for updates. Although currently a gem hidden in plain sight, word is spreading about this fascinating building and the stories locked within. Tickets to visit cost £10 for adults and £6 for under-16s, with concessions available. West Midlands Police Museum offers an interactive journey into local history while celebrating revolutionary officers of the last 130 years. It's also perfect for those with an interest in the techniques and technology the police have used to crack down on crime. For anyone keen to see a life-size police horse solve a murder or dive into the past, the museum is a real treat.
Dave Monks and his son Graham travelled to Bradgate Country Park near Leicester in search of Lady Jane Grey, the nine-day Queen of England.
Hello there, welcome to Bradgate Country Park. And I'm following Graham. He's just disappeared over the hill, and I'm puffing and panting behind. On the left-hand side is a spectacular view of the lake. Hello, I'm speaking to a couple now. Can you tell me what you think of Bradgate Country Park and going for a walk here?
Oh, it's wonderful.
The best asset absolutely we have locally,
I think. It is. Leicestershire's wow. got it's a real ace here.
Yeah.
Very
yeah.
fortunate.
Yeah.
Very varied.
The coffee shop down the road.
One in the middle and one at the other end.
Okay, so, okay. Well, I've caught up with Graham. So, which way are we going now, Graham? Which way do you want to go? Not the way you know.
We either go down to where the cars are, and still not the main car park, or go where the trees are and take a rest, but there's probably something down there.
Okay, so where's the coffee shop? Apparently there's two.
There's more than one, yeah.
Okay, let's go. This way, up through the trees. We'll try that. Okay, we've just seen a very hollow oak tree. We went into the hollowed oak tree, and there was a hole in the other side, a diamond-shaped hole, where you could see the trees in the distance through it. I've met some people there, so are you enjoying your walk?
Yes, very much so, thank you. We're a local school, and we use Exeter Park quite often.
Of course, it'll be Graham again. He's going to show me something. So what can you see?
A group of trees under there, and underneath the tree is a deer with antlers.
Oh, wow! Well, I'm speaking to you from a little road. Bradgate Country Park. Ruins, the home of Lady Jane Grey, is on the right. The left-hand side, there's a waterfall by a stream. And beyond that, there is some deer among the trees. Some young deer. We are standing watching some deer now, and they're Bambis, really. They've got fawn with white spots. I'm standing near the home of Lady Jane Grey, the ruined home, and she had a very ambitious uncle that placed her on the throne at a very tender age in her teens. But she was queen for 9 days. But Mary, a staunch Catholic, had a stronger claim to the throne and had her beheaded. I am standing next to the old ruined home at the moment. So, what's your name?
My name's Jill Rhodes. I live in Derbyshire.
Okay. Do you think you can tell me about Lady Jane Grey and the home?
I didn't know a lot about her, but I saw a letterbox this morning which had a knitted top to it. And there was a little model of Lady Jane Grey, and beside it was a card which said she was queen for 9 days and then she was beheaded, and they think that she was 16 or 17 years old, and you wonder what sort of a threat she could have been at that age.
There are oak trees around here that look as if they've been chopped through the trunk at some point and then they've re-sprouted. And the story is, it was done by the local foresters to protest about Lady Jane Grey's head chopped off. Hey, I'm speaking to David Greenwood. I understand you were former mayor of Leamington Spa, right?
Yeah, so about 15 years ago, yeah.
Okay, what do you think of Bradgate Country Park?
I think it's brilliant. We come here at least twice a year.
Yeah.
A nice walk, and in this historical context, yes. The next time we come, I'll know more about it.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Okay, bye-bye. Thanks a lot for speaking to us. Thank you.
Because we live in Derbyshire.
Oh, what wonderful area.
And this is roughly halfway between us.
And we went to university together.
Yeah. That is really nice. Yeah.
60 years ago now?
More, isn't it?
Yeah. Fantastic, thank you. Yeah. Well, we've just come across the Deer Barn Cafe and Vista Centre. So that seems like a haven to me after walking for so long. Well, we've made it back to the car park from the tea room, and that was great. We certainly did some walking, didn't we, Graham?
Yeah.
What do you think of Bradgate Park?
It's a great place, yeah.
It is. There's lots of walking, and most of it is actually wheelchair-friendly on the roads, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just that we went over the hills, and I scrambled over some rocks. But anyway, it was really nice.
Thank you very much. Access is on the main path, yeah.
Yes, you can do, certainly. Yeah. Thank you very much. That's all from our trip to Bradgate Park in Leicestershire. Thank you very much, Graham. Bye from me, Dave Monks, and bye from Graham.
Bye.
And Dave's visit brings us to the end of the programme. So until next week, from the Outlook team and me, Peter Walters, it's goodbye.